A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking what freedom of the press means in its purest form, and what some of the subtle ways are that it gets undermined. The First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of the press. But what if the most effective censorship doesn't come from Congress at all?
That's the tension, right? The text is absolute. The lived reality is anything but. And what's fascinating is that the purest definition of press freedom is actually quite narrow. It's the absence of prior restraint. No government body gets to approve what you publish before you publish it. No licensing scheme for journalists. No pre-publication review board.
Which sounds clean until you realize that's like saying you have the right to own a car, and ignoring whether you can afford gas, insurance, or whether the roads are even paved to your neighborhood.
The right exists on paper. But the infrastructure that makes it usable is a different question entirely. And that's where the subtle undermining happens, in the gap between the formal right and the practical capacity to exercise it.
Let's map this. We've got the philosophical core, Blackstone, John Stuart Mill, the Zenger trial of 1735 that established truth as a defense against libel. That's the foundation. But then there are these mechanisms that operate completely below the radar of constitutional law.
And I want to be precise about this. The purest form of press freedom means three things simultaneously. First, no prior restraint. The government cannot stop you from publishing. Second, post-publication protections that are reasonable. Defamation law exists, but it shouldn't be so punitive that it functions as a backdoor prior restraint. And third, some structural protection for the news-gathering process itself. Shield laws for sources, protection from retaliatory pressure.
That third one is where things get mushy fast, because shielding sources sounds noble. But what does protection from retaliatory pressure actually mean in practice? If a major advertiser pulls their spend because your paper ran an unflattering story, is that a press freedom issue or just capitalism?
That's the question we're going to sit in for the next half hour. Because I'd argue it absolutely is a press freedom issue, just not one the First Amendment was designed to handle. The framers were worried about kings and magistrates. They weren't thinking about algorithmic ranking systems or hedge fund consolidation.
Let's walk through the four mechanisms. Start with the one that's closest to traditional legal censorship, but dressed in a business suit.
Strategic lawsuits against public participation. And this is a mechanism that's almost elegant in its cynicism. Here's how it works. A powerful entity, corporation, developer, wealthy individual files a defamation suit against a journalist or small outlet. The suit has almost no chance of winning on the merits. But that's not the point.
The point is, the process itself is the punishment.
Discovery is expensive. Depositions are expensive. The average cost to defend a slap suit in the United States runs between $50,000 and $150,000, according to the Institute for Justice's 2025 report. For a small local paper, that's existential. You might have done absolutely nothing wrong. Your reporting might be bulletproof, but you still have to pay six figures to prove it.
That's before we talk about the time cost. You mentioned the Highland County Press case from Ohio in 2023. What happened there?
Local paper in a small Ohio county. They reported on a developer's project, standard local government accountability stuff. The developer filed a defamation suit. The paper spent 18 months fighting it. 18 months of legal fees, depositions, document production. The suit was eventually dismissed. The paper won. But during those 18 months, they lost two reporters because the budget couldn't sustain both the legal defense and the newsroom salaries.
The suit didn't need to win. It just needed to exist.
That's the mechanism. And here's what makes it particularly insidious. It creates a precedent that chills reporting far beyond the specific case. Every other small paper in Ohio sees what happened in Highland County. The next time a reporter is working on a story about a powerful developer, that editor thinks twice, not because the story is legally risky, because the process is financially ruinous even when you're right.
I want to pause on that word chills, because it's doing a lot of work here. We talk about chilling effects in the abstract, but what does it actually look like in an editorial meeting? Walk me through that moment.
Let's say you're the editor of a paper with a newsroom of 6 people and an annual legal budget of essentially zero. A reporter brings you a story about a local developer who's been funneling campaign contributions to city council members who then approved a zoning variance. The story is solid. Documents, sources, everything checks out. But you know this developer. He's litigious. He's sued the paper twice before, both suits dismissed, but each one cost $40,000 you didn't have. So you're sitting there, looking at a story that is absolutely in the public interest, absolutely true, absolutely defensible in court. And you're doing math in your head. $40,000 is a reporter's salary. Can you risk a reporter's salary on the chance that this guy sues again? And that's the chill. You haven't been censored. No one told you not to publish. But the math is the censor.
There's been some movement on anti-slap reform, though, right?
Yes. 18 states passed some form of anti-slap reform in 2024 and 2025. The idea is to create a mechanism for early dismissal of meritless suits, often with fee shifting so the plaintiff pays the defendant's legal costs. But here's the problem. Federal anti-slap legislation, the SPEAK Free Act, remains stalled as of March 2026, so you've got a patchwork. Strong protections in some states, virtually none in others.
Which means if you're a publication with a national readership, you have to worry about being sued in the least protective jurisdiction, where your story is accessible.
Which leads us to the related problem of libel tourism. And this is where things get genuinely Kafkaesque. The United Kingdom has plaintiff-friendly libel laws. The burden of proof is essentially reversed compared to the EU. The defendant has to prove the truth of the statement, rather than the plaintiff having to prove falsity. The costs can exceed £1 million. So what happens is, wealthy international figures sue in London even when the publication and the allegedly defamed subject have minimal UK connections.
Give me a concrete case.
In 2025, a UTech blog published a critical article about a British billionaire's business practices. The article had fewer than 200 UK readers, basically negligible. The billionaire's London law firm sent a letter threatening a libel suit. The blog removed the article, not because they believed they would lose on the merits, because even winning would cost them more than the publication could bear.
200 readers in the UK were enough to suppress a story that was entirely legitimate for the American audience it was actually written for.
That's the libel tourism problem in a nutshell. And the SPEAK Free Act, if it ever passes, includes provisions to make foreign libel judgments unenforceable in EU courts if they don't meet First Amendment standards. But again, stalled. So the chilling effect continues.
Here's what I want to understand about the mechanics of this. If I'm that tech blog and I get the letter from the London law firm, I have to make a decision in what, 48 hours? Before my lawyer has even finished reading the letter.
These letters typically come with a deadline. Remove the article within 7 days or we file. And the clock starts ticking before you've even retained UK counsel, before you know what the defense costs will be, before you've assessed whether your insurance covers foreign litigation. Most small outlets don't have foreign litigation insurance at all, so the decision gets made under conditions of radical uncertainty. And when the downside is potentially existential, £1 million judgment against a publication with annual revenue of maybe $300,000, the rational choice is to take the article down. Not because you were wrong, because you can't afford to be right.
That's the legal mechanism. But you said the most interesting constraints don't come from courts. They come from code.
Let's talk about algorithmic gatekeeping. And I want to be careful here because this is not censorship in the legal sense. No government agent is telling Google or Meta to suppress specific content. What's happening is more subtle and in some ways more powerful, precisely because it operates outside any framework of accountability.
Walk me through the mechanics.
Google's search algorithm and newsfeed algorithm are essentially editorial systems. They decide what content gets surfaced to users. But unlike a human editor, they're not making decisions based on newsworthiness or public interest. They're optimizing for engagement. and there's a fundamental tension between what's engaging and what's informative.
The algorithm isn't trying to suppress journalism. It's just indifferent to whether journalism survives.
Google rolled out what it called the Helpful Content Update in September 2025. The stated goal was to surface useful content and demote low-quality SEO spam. Hard to argue with that mission. But the practical effect, according to the Reuters Institute's 2025 Digital News Report, was that 47% of news publishers saw a 30% or greater drop in referral traffic from platforms in the 12 months prior.
A 30% drop in traffic is not a rounding error. That's revenue. That's staff positions. That story's not getting assigned.
Announced in April 2026 that it was further reducing news distribution across its platforms. Again, not a government action. Just a business decision by a private company that happens to control a massive share of the information distribution infrastructure.
There was that controversy during the Australian bushfire season in 2025. What happened there?
This was a revealing case. Independent climate outlets and local Australian news sites were covering the bushfires extensively. On-the-ground reporting, evacuation information, analysis of climate factors. But Google's algorithm update at the time prioritized what it called authoritative sources, which it defined as major wire services and government agencies. So, independent climate reporting got buried in search results during a literal crisis, while generic wire copy from Reuters and AP surfaced at the top.
That's not a human making a decision to suppress climate journalism. That's an algorithmic preference for institutional authority over on-the-ground expertise.
That distinction matters tremendously for how we think about press freedom. If a government official told Google to bury independent climate coverage, that would be a clear First Amendment violation, state action. But when the algorithm does the same thing as a byproduct of an update designed to fight SEO spam, there's no legal remedy, no one to sue, no one to hold accountable.
Because the algorithm didn't intend to suppress journalism. It just didn't care whether journalism was collateral damage.
That's the phrase. And what makes this a press freedom issue, even though it's not a legal violation, is that the practical effect is identical to censorship. Stories that are reported, fact-checked, and published never reach their audience. The press is free to publish, but the distribution infrastructure roots around it.
I want to push on this a little, because I can already hear the counter-argument. Someone's going to say, look, Google and our private companies, they're not obligated to distribute anyone's content. If journalists want to reach audiences, build your own distribution channels. What's wrong with that argument?
Nothing, in theory. In practice, the distribution infrastructure is so concentrated that build your own is like telling someone to build their own highway system. Google controls roughly 90% of search traffic, controls the social feed for billions of users. You can build the best website in the world, but if neither platform surfaces your content, you're essentially invisible. The market for attention is not a free market. It's a market with two enormous gatekeepers who control the on-ramps.
Those gatekeepers didn't ask for the job of deciding what news reaches the public. They inherited it as a byproduct of building advertising businesses.
They're not in the news business. They're in the attention business. News just happens to be one category of content that competes for attention. And when the algorithm determines that news content doesn't optimize for engagement as well as, say, short-form video or emotionally charged user-generated content, news gets deprioritized. Not because anyone at Google dislikes journalism, because the math says journalism underperforms on the metrics that drive revenue.
We've got legal chilling through slap suits and libel tourism. We've got algorithmic suppression through engagement optimized ranking. What's the third mechanism?
And I realize this sounds less dramatic than lawsuits and shadow banning. But stay with me, because the structural implications are arguably more profound.
The argument being that a free press behind a paywall isn't free for the public that can't afford it.
Let me give you the numbers. Neiman Lab published data in January 2026 showing that the average annual cost for a bundle of five major news subscriptions is now $487. That's The Atlantic, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, and one more. Pick your fifth. $487 a year.
Which prices out roughly what portion of you?
About 40%. And that's not including local papers, which increasingly have their own paywalls. So what you get is a two-tier information ecosystem. People who can afford $487 a year get access to independent, professionally reported journalism. Everyone else gets whatever surfaces through social media algorithms, which, as we just discussed, are actively deprioritizing news content.
The poor get algorithmically curated fragments, and the wealthy get actual journalism.
Before anyone says this is just how markets work, I understand the business argument. Journalism costs money to produce. Ad-supported models collapsed because Google and captured the ad market. Subscriptions are the only viable path for many outlets. I'm not saying publications are wrong to charge for their work.
The structural outcome is still a constraint on press freedom in the functional sense. The press is free to publish, but a huge portion of the public is priced out of reading it.
This creates a feedback loop that's worth examining. If your audience is disproportionately affluent and educated, your editorial priorities shift. Not through any conspiracy, just through market incentives. Stories that matter to lower-income communities get less coverage. Labor issues, rural poverty, housing insecurity. These topics don't drive subscriptions from the demographic that can afford $487 a year.
Can we make this concrete? Give me an example of a story that gets covered less because of this dynamic.
Take rural hospital closures. Between 2020 and 2025, more than 100 rural hospitals in the United States closed their doors. This is a massive public health story. It affects millions of people. It involves complex questions of Medicare reimbursement policy, private equity acquisition of healthcare facilities, state-level decisions about Medicaid expansion. But the communities affected are disproportionately low-income and rural, exactly the demographic that's least likely to hold a bundle of news subscriptions. So the story gets covered, but not with the depth and persistence that it would if the affected communities were the core subscriber base.
The paywall doesn't just limit who reads the news. It shapes what gets reported in the first place.
Which brings us to the fourth mechanism, and I think this one is the most insidious because it's entirely internal. Not the dramatic kind where a government censor redacts paragraphs. The quiet kind where an editor kills a story before it's even pitched because they've internalized all the constraints we just discussed.
Preemptive editorial narrowing.
The Committee to Protect Journalists did a survey in 2024. 62% of you journalists said they self-censor at least occasionally. That's up from 41% in 2020. In 4 years, the number jumped 21 points.
What were the top reasons?
Fear of online harassment was number one, 34%. Fear of employer retaliation was second at 28%. Fear of losing access to sources was third at 22%. Notice what's not on the list.
The most common reason journalists hold back is that they're afraid of being mobbed on social media.
This isn't abstract. There was a freelance journalist in Texas in 2024 who stopped covering school board meetings after receiving death threats and having their home address published online. The police declined to investigate, citing free speech protections for the harassers. So you have a situation where the journalist's free speech rights are constrained by someone else's free speech rights, and the state's position is essentially neutrality between them.
Which is a failure of the state to protect the press function, even if it's not a violation of the First Amendment text.
The harassment is private action, not state action. The police declining to investigate is arguably state inaction, not state suppression. But the practical outcome is that a journalist stops covering a public institution because the personal cost is too high. The school board meetings go uncovered. The public loses oversight. And none of this triggers any First Amendment scrutiny.
I want to connect this back to something you said earlier about the Highland County Press case, because there's a pattern here. In both cases, the mechanism works because the cost of being right is higher than the cost of staying quiet. Whether it's legal fees or death threats, the journalist who does their job correctly still pays a price. And the system is structured so that price falls entirely on the individual journalist or the individual outlet, not on the person causing the harm.
That's the asymmetry. The developer who files a meritless slap suit risks nothing if they lose. The online harasser who posts a journalist's home address faces no consequences. But the journalist risks everything, their savings, their safety, their career. And when the risk-reward calculus is that lopsided, the rational choice, over time, is to avoid the risk, which means avoiding the story. Which means the public never learns what the developer was doing or what happened at the school board meeting.
Let's talk about the economic consolidation piece. You mentioned Alden Global Capital.
Alden is the poster child for what happens when hedge fund logic meets local journalism. As of 2025, they owned more than 200 newspapers. Their model is straightforward. Buy papers, strip costs, extract profit, and if the paper eventually dies, sell the real estate. The average local paper in an Alden portfolio now has about 1.3 reporters covering an entire county.
1.3 reporters for 50,000 people.
That's not a newsroom. That's a gesture toward having a newsroom. When you have 1.3 reporters, you can't cover city council meetings. You can't investigate the county budget. You can't do enterprise reporting on the school system. You're essentially running press releases and wire copy.
That's not censorship by decree. It's censorship by attrition.
That's the phrase I'd use. No one told those papers not to cover City Hall. They just made it structurally impossible to do so. And the First Amendment has absolutely nothing to say about it because the government isn't involved. A private equity firm made a business decision.
What's the counterargument here? That newspapers were dying anyway, and hedge fund ownership at least keeps the lights on.
That's the defense Alden would offer. But there's evidence that the extraction model accelerates the death spiral rather than preventing it. Papers get worse. Subscribers leave. The hedge fund cuts more costs to maintain margins. The paper gets worse still. It's a revenue death spiral, and the endpoint is a publication that exists in name only.
Then there's the case of The Appeal. What happened there?
The Appeal was a nonprofit criminal justice outlet, won major awards, did impactful investigative work on prosecutorial misconduct, prison conditions, sentencing disparities, shut down in 2025, not because their journalism was bad, not because they faced legal threats, because foundation funding dried up.
Where did the money go?
Donors shifted priorities to AI and climate, which are important topics. But the structural problem is that journalism that holds the criminal justice system accountable is now dependent on the philanthropic preferences of a handful of foundations. When those preferences shift, the journalism disappears. That's not a free press. That's a press on a patronage model.
Patronage has always existed. Newspapers have always had owners with interests. But the consolidation means fewer patrons with more concentrated power.
Less diversity of editorial judgment. When 200 papers are owned by the same hedge fund, you don't need a memo from headquarters telling editors what not to cover. The incentives are baked into the staffing levels. You can't cover what you don't have reporters to cover.
Let's pull back and try to synthesize this. We've got four mechanisms. Legal chilling through slap suits and libel tourism. Algorithmic gatekeeping through engagement-optimized ranking. Economic barriers through paywalls and hedge fund consolidation. And self-censorship, through fear of harassment and retaliation.
What connects all four is that none of them involve a government official saying you cannot publish this. The First Amendment is intact. The legal right is secure. But the practical capacity to exercise that right is eroding across multiple fronts simultaneously.
Which means the binary question, is the press free or not, is the wrong question entirely.
The better question is what you alluded to earlier, free for whom, to do what, under what constraints. A well-funded national outlet with in-house counsel and a subscriber base of affluent readers operates under very different constraints than a small local paper in a rural county. Both are technically free. One is meaningfully free.
The danger of focusing only on the legal definition is that you can point to the intact First Amendment and say everything's fine, while the actual infrastructure of journalism crumbles.
This is what I find frustrating about a lot of press freedom discourse. It's focused on the most dramatic threats. Journalists arrested, newspapers shut down by decree, explicit state censorship. Those things happen and they matter. But in the United States in 2026, the more pervasive threats are quieter. No one's getting arrested. They're just running out of money, or losing their distribution channels, or deciding that a story isn't worth the harassment it'll generate.
What do we actually do about this? If you're a journalist or an editor, what's the actionable step?
One thing I'd recommend is what I'd call a chill audit. Go back through the last year of editorial decisions. Map every story you didn't pursue. Categorize the reason. Was it legal fear? Source access concern? Platform dependency worry? Most newsrooms have never done this systematically because the decisions not to pursue stories are invisible by nature. You can't see what wasn't published.
The pattern would be revealing.
and it would give you a map of where your editorial independence is actually constrained, as opposed to where you think it's constrained. I suspect most newsrooms would find that the biggest constraints aren't legal at all. They're economic and social.
What about for listeners who are journalists? What's the lever they can actually pull?
First, support structural solutions, not just individual outlets. A subscription to your local paper matters, but anti-SLAPP legislation at the federal level matters more because it protects the entire ecosystem. The Local Journalism Sustainability Act was reintroduced in February 2026 with bipartisan co-sponsors. That's the kind of thing that could actually move the needle, public funding for local news that's structurally insulated from political interference. Platform regulation that requires algorithmic transparency. Right now, when Google or changes their algorithm and news referral traffic drops 30%, publishers have no recourse. They can't even get a clear explanation of what changed. Requiring platforms to disclose the effects of algorithm updates on news distribution wouldn't solve the problem, but it would make the mechanism visible. And visibility is the prerequisite for accountability. Recognize that press freedom isn't binary. The question isn't, is the press free? It's free for whom, to do what, under what constraints? That reframing matters because it allows for targeted intervention rather than vague outrage. If the constraint is legal, the solution is legal reform. If the constraint is economic, the solution is funding models. If the constraint is algorithmic, the solution is platform accountability.
The purest form of press freedom, the right to publish without prior restraint, is alive in the United States. But the ability to publish without structural constraint is eroding.
The distinction matters enormously, because defending the former while ignoring the latter is how a free press becomes a formal right with no practical power. You can have a First Amendment that's perfectly enforced and a press that's functionally constrained to the point of irrelevance. Those two things can coexist.
Which raises the question, if the most effective constraints on press freedom are now economic and algorithmic, what does the next generation of press freedom advocacy look like? Is it legal reform? New funding models? All of the above?
I think it has to be all of the above, but with a shift in emphasis. For decades, press freedom advocacy has been primarily a legal project, defending the First Amendment, fighting prior restraint, pushing back against libel suits. That work is still necessary, but it's no longer sufficient. The threats have migrated to domains where the law has very little to say.
The advocacy has to migrate too.
It has to become an economic project and a technological project, not just a legal one, which is harder because the levers are less obvious. You can't file an amicus brief against an algorithm update. You can't sue a hedge fund for understaffing a newsroom.
You can build alternative infrastructure, nonprofit news models, public funding mechanisms that don't create dependency.
You can change the conversation so that when people talk about threats to press freedom, they're not only picturing journalists in jail. They're also picturing the reporter who stops covering school board meetings because the harassment isn't worth it. The paper that can't afford to fight a meritless lawsuit. The outlet that disappears when a foundation shifts its funding priorities.
The jail cell is more dramatic. The quiet erosion is more dangerous, precisely because it's quiet.
That's the insight I want people to sit with. The most effective censorship in 2026 doesn't look like censorship. It looks like a business decision. An algorithm tweak? A budget cut. A journalist deciding that a story isn't worth the personal cost. None of it triggers the alarm bells that explicit censorship would trigger. But the cumulative effect is a press that's less capable of doing its job than it was a decade ago.
That's the thing about structural constraints. They don't need to be coordinated to be effective. The hedge fund executive, the platform engineer, the foundation program officer, and the online harasser are not working together. They don't share goals, but the combined effect of their actions is a press environment that's substantially less free in practice than it is in theory.
Which brings us back to where we started. The text of the First Amendment is absolute. Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of the press, and Congress, for the most part, hasn't. The law is intact. The right is secure. But the ecosystem that gives that right meaning is not.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the early 1500s, Spanish explorers in what is now Tajikistan documented a carnivorous plant known as the blood cup, which trapped insects in a viscous red fluid that local herders used to treat wounds. The plant was believed extinct for centuries until a small population was rediscovered in 2023, growing in a remote mountain valley accessible only by a single narrow pass.
Right.
A carnivorous plant used as medicine.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
A free press isn't just a legal right. It's an infrastructure project. And infrastructure needs maintenance.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My Weird Prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My Weird Prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.